Today is Tuesday, May 9th, 2023. This is part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Scott Imsland. Scott spells his last name I-M-S-L-A-N-D. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Scott. How are you today?
All's well. Good morning to you. It's nice to talk to you again.
Yes.
And send me back in time and re-remember all these events that go on in 30 years of guiding or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Scott, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yeah, that's fine.
Thank you.
That's good.
We left off the end of part 5. You had finally made the transition to work at Grand Canyon in the early 1970s. Can you pick that storyline up for us?
Yeah. I had been working, guiding in Idaho for quite some time, and at that time, it was interesting that the office out in Oakland, California, would send out trainees for us to work into the system and kind of bring them into the guiding and boatman group. And some of those guys, I don't know how ARTA in Oakland, which is where the office was, where they found these Vietnam vets, but they would get sent out to us. And I had mentioned one story. All those guys were really wonderful. They were happy to not be at war. They were happy to be doing something like gutting on these mountainous rivers. And it was so different than what they'd been going through. So it was really nice to have them. And they developed into really good boatmen and very savvy, very strong-willed and capable guys, and that was great. And just one of the stories, the only thing that I noticed, since that was kind of the Vietnam era and we were just getting out of there, one of the fellows that was sent out to us was, we didn't find out that he had so much effect, PTSD from what war he had to go through in Vietnam, but he came into of disagreement and a struggle with a passenger towards the end of our trip in Idaho on the Middle Fork Salmon. And they got into a fight and rolled around on the ground, and this Carl pulled his knife out. And I was present there, but I didn't understand what all this nearby commotion was all about. But the other guys had seen that Carl had pulled a knife out, and here you have just this innocent little passenger, a dad, going, my God, this guy's going crazy. But we stopped that, and everything worked out fine, but that was kind of a big eye-opening moment for a lot of us there, that we were not in the war, we were not in Vietnam. We either got out of the war, and we were lucky, and these were the people that were coming from that war, and it was very interesting, and we all eventually got along, and particularly when I came to Grand Canyon, there were more of those fellows that were just great boatmen, great guides, great savvy. They were capable, strong, and had their wits about them. They had been through, not that the war gave them all this, but they were just nice guys, and they would, you know, if you said, you need to hike up to the top of that mountain and get some firewood and haul it back, they were gone, off, boom, done. What else do you need? Mm-hmm. So that was a.
Can you tell me about a couple of those people?
Yeah, they were the two that I'm thinking of was Bill Alexander and John Otterbein, and they happened to have been on the same ship in the Navy off the coast of Vietnam, and that's where they were stationed. And those two guys were just really just great personalities. You know, I think some of it shows when you have been in battle or you've been in situations of that nature in war. They were so happy just to, like, wow, here I am guiding on a Grand Canyon, Colorado River trip. I mean, I've got a job rowing boats on the Grand Canyon and taking hikes and cooking and campfires and all this stuff. So it was really, really fun for these guys. And my brother actually came out, who had been in Vietnam in battle, and he came on one of my ARTA trips as an invitation, and he was just overwhelmingly with joy to have all of a sudden something normal in his life and not being shot at or bombs not being dropped. And he just was so, I mean, really stunned by the fact that this is another world. I'm not in that old world now. I am in the Grand Canyon. I'm rowing a boat with my brother. And that was, you know, that's just a taste of the guys and how they appreciated. And it was just, I'm just with ARDA, but there are motor rig trips that probably had many more of those kind of veterans that were helping Hatch out and Western out and whatever. So, but they were good boatmen.
Mm-hmm.
They were solid people. And I still keep in contact with some of them to this day.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Very cool.
That's about all I have on the vets that were brought to us. And I think part of it, the office was being very kind and open to bringing people in and sending them out to us and training them and so forth. So it was kind of was a nice altruistic kind of thing that went on to blend them into a working crew, and it all worked out really well.
You know, I think Georgie White was the first woman to row a boat through the Grand Canyon in 1952 with Elgin Pierce. When did the first women guides show up working for ARDA? Were they already on scene when you showed up, or did they come in a little after
No,
that?
Not at all. No, not at all, because the boats were really big, and the size of the boats, it was unknown with the dynamics of the Colorado River, the rapids, the speed, the flow of the water, the volume of water. It was at a time when the snout rigs that I've talked about that we rode, and then those the bigger ones, the shorty pontoons, that was an era when we or nobody knew what could handle the Grand Canyon if you wanted to row and not have a big motor rig. What could survive down there? And we just didn't know what a length, width, size we should have. So that's where the shorty pontoons, 28 feet or so, and then the snout rigs that came on as a better, you know, system than the big slug kind of boats. And it took a while for, like, Avon Pros to get there and the whole river rafting industry to catch up, like, and develop boats that were good whitewater boats. That was not at all existing. They were all World War World War II. The Korean War was supplying us when those were over in the surplus stores. You could get the ammunition cans to put food and stuff in and keep things waterproof, and the pontoons came from those wars. So nothing had in the industry been developed yet to row. The women, getting back to the women, those boats were huge and heavy and very difficult to maneuver. And I don't think anybody thought that it was capable for women to do it. And we weren't sure how much we could tolerate it, because we had people, the boats were heavy, they were clunky, awkward, and it was just a real training period of time for everybody. And we did a really good job of keeping rowing going and the business going. And slowly we got out of the snouts, out of the big other big boats. We got out of that and moved over and caught up with industry that was making rafts that, which Avon, it seemed to me, Avon started the most trustworthy boats. So that I rode the Avon Pros a lot down there.
When was that? When was your first Avon run? Do you remember?
This would be, I guess, because the snouts were my first couple years, 3 years probably were with snouts.
Okay.
And if you can back figure what that would
be. I'm thinking 74, 75-ish?
Yeah, probably somewhere around there, because that's right. Also, maybe a little before that, because I brought my snout experience into M&A, which was in the early 70s up until like 76 or 7. So I would say, yeah, I probably started in those in the early 70s somewhere. That might be about right.
Okay.
And because you couple that, I didn't do any of that. It was all snout rigs from that point on. And that's when I got into M&A also with that little period too, when that stayed with them until the latter 70s. Do you want to go stay in the Colorado boat-wise or move on to experiences and getting finally into M&A and that? You want to,
Scott?
Go?
I want it all. Where do you
want
to take me?
All.
Where do you? And
okay.
Let's just try to follow the chronological timeline. And if we have multiple threads,
yeah.
We have multiple threads. But we'll just hang on to time as we go.
Yeah, and you you've been really good about saying, well, I think that would place you about here, and probably this happened at this year and so forth. You know, I agree with you because I think have got a perspective on certain things along that. And I can't necessarily remember, you know, specific year of this and that happening, but I'm giving you as good as
right.
I can.
Right, we'll rough it all in. Yeah.
Yeah, and you've already pinpointed a few things as, well, if this happened, that had to happen, and so forth. So, the floods of 83, yeah, so that, I'm going to back up into
yes,
back
please.
The 70s.
Yeah, back up into the 70s.
Yeah, and the 70s, I was mentioning the camping at Grapevine, and the 60s still carried on, and so forth, and what happened, nudity was a very common group-wise experience for passengers and us kind of ushering in, be free, you know. You're out here in the Grand Canyon, there's no rights or wrongs, and if you want to get naked and dance around the fire, of which we could have fires back then, and we'll have a big party, you know, and we'll break out whatever wine was for dinner, and pot would probably be smoked, and I can remember at Grapevine dancing around and all the people singing, and this is a whole group, mostly all naked, going around a beautiful, big in the center bonfire, nighttime stars, and enough light from the fires to do whatever we wanted to do, whatever the people wanted to do. But it's amazing to think back that we opened up the doors for so many city people just to cut loose, you know, and it wasn't necessarily any of the drugs that did it, although, you know, pot was very prevalent. Nothing harder than that was ever a part of my trips anyway. And so people would just danced and sang, and there was guitars there, which a lot of it was just vocal, but sometimes guitars would fit in. And so on that particular trip, we finished it out, and it stayed happy, gay, and merry the whole time. And I came into Diamond Creek. We were taken out of Diamond Creek at this period. And the lady, in a minute, I'll probably remember her name, but who would, with the Hualapais, who would get money for taking out there. And I brought my boat in to the takeout there at Diamond, and all of my boat was naked. I was naked, and all the people on the boat, all the passengers were naked. And we didn't think anything about it. We had been on the river for so long, and we'd done so much hiking and raw stuff, and we'd become such a family. I don't think nobody thought anything about bringing a boat in. The trip was over.
Huh?
You know, we're going to dock and blah, blah, blah. But Beecham, I think her last name was Miriam Beecham. Beecham is a very
lovely Hualapai family.
Oh, yeah. I don't know them other than I started with them. When we started taking out at Diamond Creek, she was tacitly involved in
just watching all these boats come in, and I think finally they go, you know, we can make money off of this, and because we are cutting off the takeout point by several miles, and it's a real convenience. So anyway, I came in, and I had known her from takeouts before, and I didn't think anything about bringing a buttload of naked people in, but it really blew her mind, and that made it all the way back to Arda, and that's when I got a letter saying that I was fired for bringing a boatload of people in, and it got to the Park Service, it got to Beecher, and so all of a sudden, in 73, I was finding that I'd been fired and I wasn't a part of the ARTA business anymore. And I went up to Oakland and talked to them all about what was going on, and they talked about, you know, we're a business and, you know, we need the takeout there and we can't offend the Hualapais and on and on. And I go, yeah, I agree, totally. It was just what that 3 weeks worth of trip was all about. We didn't even think of it. It was right or wrong. So the point of all this, outside of just describing the lifestyle down in that period of time, is that Peter Wynn knew I got fired. And Peter was taking on a job for the National Park Service, and he had he knew that MNA had gotten some boats from ARTA to start doing some ecological surveys down the Grand Canyon, and they'd gotten a big, I don't know if it's multi-million-dollar grant, but a lot of money from the feds to study and find out what is down in Grand Canyon. There hasn't been any investigation since the 1920s, and we want a total inventory of Grand Canyon bugs, fish, water temperature, beaches, mammals, on and on, trees, flowers, all that stuff.
So hey, Scott, you're reminding me that right about that time in the, between 70 and 75, the Park Service started working on a river management plan.
That's exactly right. I was right there in that.
Okay, and they needed a lot of studies. They needed they wanted to know about the aquatic, you know, biological community and the avian community and the boating community and the whole deal. So
everything.
And so MNA is the Museum of Northern Arizona that's here in Flagstaff, mm-hmm. Arizona. And so they must have received a contract then to start working on these studies.
That's exactly right. They got a big, I don't know how many, at least a million or more.
Okay.
And that's where I came in.
Okay.
And I had been fired. I hadn't the job. Peter Wynn was, started them out. Peter started out M&A, did one trip with them, and then took a job with the Park Service as a ranger and said, you know, I'm going to take this job with the rangers and run a motor rig down there for them. And I suggest that you get a hold of Scott Imsland, and he needs to work, needs a job. He wants to row boats and guide and so forth.
Okay.
And he's been down there a lot, and he would be a good choice. So they got a hold of me. M&A got a hold of me. And
do you remember who contacted you?
Well, Steve Crothers got the permit, and Steve would have had the say on whose recommendation he would follow. And Peter had set them up, was teaching Steve how to row, and told him, you know, Scott would be good for M&A and for you and the whole project with the Park Service.
So okay.
Get a hold of him. So I imagine with Steve Crothers. So I drove out there and met everybody and saw what gear and equipment they had and found out, you know, what they needed from me and what they wanted to do and how long the contract went, which started in the early 70s, and it went out until probably about 70. I think I worked for them until about 76, and my last guiding commercial was 77.
Okay.
It was fortuitous that I got fired. It turned out to be what a windfall, because now I had a place, I had a steady money coming in from M&A. I had a place to live, plenty of food. I had contacts with all sorts of key people in Flagstaff and in the research, biology, geology, archaeology.
Where were you living?
Paleontology. They gave me a on the property of M&A. There were trailers, which I got to stay in a trailer. Eventually, they gave me the trailer to live in.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They didn't want to use it anymore. So if I could find a place in Flagstaff to pull the trailer, you could have the trailer. We're done with it. Mm-hmm. So they not only put me up in a trailer, they gave me the trailer to live in all my time in Flagstaff until I left in 1980.
Where did you move it to when you pulled it off?
I think it was next to a big grocery store and was just off of, I can't remember all the names in Flagstaff of the streets and so forth. It was by, I imagine the grocery store is still there, but it was just right off of the main drag if you wanted to go from the university, out to the volcano, Sunset Crater, and whatever it was, whatever that main street is to get out of town.
Route 66?
Right off of that. 66?
Yeah, would be Route 66 through town, and then,
what is it? It's like 80-something, doesn't it go up to Lee's Ferry? Is that 86 or 80?
Highway 89.
89.
Yeah.
It'd be like that. Okay. That's where the trailer is. And that was very interesting. It was free. I don't know how I towed it. I had my brown Ford truck. I probably just pulled it over there.
Okay.
And I was in a community of Hopis and Navajos.
Wow.
And that was fascinating. And I really enjoyed. I was sandwiched in between row after row after row of Navajos, and then at M&A I was around the Hopis. I don't remember so many Navajos working at M&A, but the Hopis did.
Okay.
And artists and so forth. And so anyway, that parking, that where the trailer was kind of central to everything. And I had all the services I could ever want. And they had a payphone there, so anybody wanted to get a hold of me, they had to tell me what time they wanted to call, and I go to the payphone and listen for my call to come in. So I didn't have a phone, and that was a perfect way to like get away from having to pay for a service on a phone.
Nice.
And that was, everything was there. That trailer was like perfect. And if you know Larry Stevens, do you know
yes,
Larry Stevens?
I do.
Okay. Larry was, I taught him how to row on the M&A because he was doing all the bug work and any other biology stuff. And then when I left town, I gave or sold him my trailer, which he took over for a while.
Okay.
And, I don't know how long, but that's, Larry was a great guy. I really enjoyed Larry.
Cool.
And so basically, okay, back. So being fired, I got a great job with M&A. And then they go, well, Scott, what are we going to do with you? You're going to be on the river for 3 weeks at a time. Then you're going to be off. Then you're going to go back on. And I set up pretty much the schedule. When do you want to go? When Steve might say, Carruthers might say, oh, we should do an autumn trip, or we should do a winter trip, or we should do a hot summer trip. We got to hit all the seasons. So, whatever trips, whatever dates you want, give me some dates, and those will be the dates we do. And how many trips do you want to do in the year? And okay, we'll do 10 trips. We've done that month. Let's do this month now, and let's concentrate on this and that. And we've got various biologists coming from around the U.S. To study this and that. And when do you think is a good time? When will what do you think about the water flows and this and that? So I was in charge of all that stuff, and also we didn't have boatman. Steve was still in training, and he had his snout rig, and so I was training him as we were going down the river, and keeping an eye on him. And then we really needed guys that were the biologist crew or whatever was with us to start learning how to row. and help out with the boats and actually be not only their scientists, but they've got to help get boats down. They've got to learn how to row and so forth. So that's what I also did, too, to get an up-and-running bunch of scientist guides that could row boats, and gear would be put on their boats, and you got to be good enough not to wreck your boats, lose your boats, rip your boats up.
Is that where Larry came in then?
Yeah. So okay. Larry was on the grant to do his bug work. So they needed people doing bug work. But Larry was such a biologist. He was such a scientist. He was such a great, well-rounded guy. And so I picked out who I thought would be good amongst the various guys that we went on the trips with. And Larry was somebody I thought that had the temperament and the savvy to learn and be a critical component of the guides on the trip. And then I Stuart Acheson, I don't know if you know Stuart. I don't know if he's still around.
By name, yes.
Like Stuart Acheson. Well, he was there, and I'd also picked Stuart, and he had his own little boat and said, yeah, you can row your little boat down there, and you're going to have gear in it, but I'll work with you, and we'll see how you do.
So when you say little, do you mean like 18 foot when compared to the snouts
it was only Steve and I on the snout rigs, and then a little boat was, you know, something like a rubber ducky kind of thing is what Stuart has.
Oh, you mean like a one man or something, a one or two man inflatable?
Yeah, like maybe a two or three at max, you know, but it was like what he had, and I didn't care, you know, if he wanted to figure out how to get that down to Colorado, that was fine, and you'll get a taste of what's going on. So he didn't make it too much farther past that. You know, it's kind of like when I was talking about the servicemen being sent out to the hinterlands to row boats, and they don't know what they're doing. You know, that's kind of what I was. I didn't have a few boatmen that I gathered up and went with me. I did at times on some of the winter trips. I said we need to have this and such join us, and we would do that. So Peter would join me, Tom Olson would join me, a few other I can't think of right now. But I would try and get whatever I felt was safe to go down with, and who I could trust running a boat and get us down without flipping anything or putting them on rocks somewhere. So, but that's when, I accepted the job. They gave me everything I wanted. And then this goes back to, like, I had the river trips would lasted 3 weeks and then a week or two off and then go back out again. And they said, well, what are we going to do with you when you're not on the river? And my friend Bill Breed, the geologist at MNA, he said, you know, why don't we share Scott, and he would be really good on the paleontology and geology stuff that we've got going, because we have scientists and people coming from around the world, and we go out on digs and look for dinosaurs, and we maybe some archaeology stuff, a lot of geology. They said Scott would work out really good getting all the gear together for us, cooking, equipment we needed. And so that's what happened, is that if I wasn't on the river, I was tied in with archaeology and paleontology.
What fun.
So I got to go out and do lots of dinosaur digs and shark digs on Navajo Reservation. Maybe some on the Hopi, but it seemed like we had carte blanche in the Navajo reservations, like a folder full of permits to be out there doing what we were doing, which was all legal. It was just, it was interesting how not everybody gets to go out and do this. And so I got to do that. And
what do you remember about Bill Breed?
He was a man that opened the doors to many, many opportunities. He just kind of put me under his wing, and
I almost called Colbert. Yeah, Ned Colbert. Ned Colbert was the fellow that defined and proved that the continents drifted apart at some point and proved that.
So plate tectonics.
Exactly. He proved with finding specimens in the Antarctic that were there as well as in, I think, South America.
Okay.
Not sure on all this, but he was famous for tying all of this together with the fossils that he had found, and that was probably what he probably had a hunch that if we find, this is what I think happened. I think everything was tied together at some point, and then at some point, the island, not islands, but the continents drifted apart. And how do I prove that? I'm just thinking like how he might have thought. But mm-hmm, Ned Colbert mm-hmm. was a great guy, and he had a lot of he'd done so much and was so important in that world that brought people to Flagstaff and to M&A that were in that business.
Okay.
Their jobs. So you got to see, and sometimes they might have even gone on river trips with me, or they for sure we went out on digs together. And there was the VIP veteran. There was a big session of paleontologists that came to M&A and to Flagstaff for the biggest national meeting possible. It came to Flagstaff, and so lots of talks were done, and people that were from around the world giving their stories and their ideas on this and that. And I got to see these guys that to this day, you know, this is what we think happened in Grand Canyon. This is how this happened, blah, blah, blah. And somebody else gets up and said, well, that couldn't have happened because of this. How do you deal with, you know, this structure here? And that's not in your idea, you know. And so it was very interesting to hear the back and forth on how things worked, especially particularly Grand Canyon. I mean, I would say to this day that nobody knows how that thing was done.
Right.
And it was certainly that way. I got to see everybody pushing their own ideas. It was kind of an ego thing. I took from it, it's like all these hotshots really wanted to say, I did that, and that's my, you know, that's my history, and that's my evidence, and on. But so I got to see a lot of that stuff, and Bill almost got me to go to Antarctica.
Oh, wow.
Follow-up. It was very close. It was barely more than saying, yeah, I've got the time. I'll go to Antarctica on the such-and-such boat, fly into here. Actually, so he got to see a lot of where I would have been going there, and the Quonset huts that were set up down there, and what they do and where they're investigating. That would have been really awesome. But okay. Bill was opening up doors like that to me all the time.
Did he encourage you to go to school, to go to university there? The Northern Arizona
No.
University was just down the road there in Flagstaff.
Yes. So what happened with that was that, Blythe Troy was the man that was hired to run MNA while I was there.
Sorry, what was his name?
Blythe Troy was his last name. Blythe Troy.
B-L-I-B-T-R-O-Y?
You'll have to guess on that, or you can go over to M&A and find out.
Yeah, so if I can Google it, sure.
Yeah, and so before that was Ned Danson.
Yes.
And Ned Danson moved out of it, kind of, and they brought on Blythe Troy, and he wanted to know, like, so what do you use, Scott? With M&A, and I said, well, I run all the river trips and all the stuff that we got the grant for that is paying for a lot of stuff that's going on now with M&A, and yeah, I'm in charge of those trips and the science and all that. And he kind of befriended me and liked, I guess, you know, my energy or what I was doing, and he told me, you know, Scott, you won't be doing this river running stuff
forever. And you have got an opportunity now that you're working at M&A. You've got a place to stay here. You have no costs whatsoever. You're living for free and working, making a small wage. And if I were you, while you've got this opportunity, you should go over to the university and start going to school over there while in your off time. Or I think this is also happening when I was pretty much done with the river trips and stuff. And he was saying, you can stay here. We're going to give you a trailer. And you should think about your future away from the river running stuff because you won't do it forever.
This is Ned Danson telling you that.
No, not Ned. He was just a nice guy. We would party together, and they had things at the Colbert Mansion or whatever it was called up there. And I finished pretty much with Carruthers and the river trips and so forth, but I was still a part of the research, the dinosaur stuff and all that stuff. And so this was Bleibtreu sitting me down and saying, you've got all this stuff going for you now.
Okay.
This is an opportunity. Go over to NIU and start taking classes in whatever you want to do, but start setting yourself up for the future. And we will support you, and it's not going to cost you anything to live here. And so I thought about that, and I go, God, that's exactly right. I mean, I've got everything. Then I go over to NAU, and I find out that I can get a grant of money that I could invest and make more money, you know, as a savings account. I didn't need the money, but I was able to qualify for a grant from NAU.
Huh.
I don't know. I don't remember what the name of it was, but it was great. Here, I would go over there. It was costing me nothing to go to school, and I'd wanted to learn a trade, so I went through engineering classes and industrial classes, which were basically for engineers had to take all the classes I took so that they knew what was going on when they designed stuff.
Okay.
Complexity of an item, it was too complex, it cost too much money. So I was going to school with all these engineers, and I was there only to learn a trade, and I had picked all these various courses that got me up with all the engineers. And then when it was all said and done, I had talked to the man in charge of all that engineering stuff, and I told him that when I graduated from NAU, I didn't want a teaching credential, but I wanted to walk and knock on any door that could take my skills and hire me. And the fellow that was running all that industrial stuff was from Brooklyn, and he knew when I talked to him about what I needed and wanted, it was like I was talking to Bleibtreu again, or he was throwing everything back at me. He knew exactly what I was talking about. I told him I would not probably finish my time here, but I want you to know the reason I'm here is to learn a trade so when I walk out, I can get a job anywhere I want to go, Europe, America, Canada, wherever. And he understood that 100%. And so he supported me and taught me all the way through my 3 years or more at NAU. And so when I got out, I had the river seasons to start again. And so I told him, I'm out of here now. I'm going to start rowing boats again for the season. And I thanked him and so forth. And, so I was trained, and I went over to, what's the name of the big plant in Flagstaff?
Gore? W.L. Gore?
Gore, yeah. I went over to W.L. Gore, and after the season was over, and I probably hurt my back. That's probably one of the things that happens. I hurt my back rowing, was helicoptered out at Phantom, and that put me on the sidelines for a good year and a half. Rowing boats, rowing those big boats all those years in the wind, low water.
Was that a commercial trip or was that an M&A trip?
It was a commercial trip that I flew out on.
Okay.
And they flew in guides to cover what I was doing. But anyway, so that hurt my back. And I go, I've got to implement my training that I've just spent 4 years doing. Hmm. And I went over to Watkins Johnson, and they were, or W.L. Gore, I don't know if I've got different companies involved. But I went over to W.L. Gore, and I talked to Bill Gore, who owns and runs all the companies he had around the world. And I told him what I did, like I've just told you, and I'm here to get a job. And I think what I've learned at NAU, I can do it. And he hired me, and he says, here's a pamphlet. These are the philosophies of my company, and you have access to everybody, including myself and my wife, if we're in town, to come and make a complaint, make a suggestion, how things could be better. These are really bad. And I want you to understand that this is a place like no other. And we were working on the Teflon graphs that are still in use today, actually. Teflon graphs out of the heart, in the leg. And then most of my time was working with the heart valves. And the heart valves were a really, really difficult thing to engineer and manufacture. So it didn't go, because you put a bad valve into somebody and it kills them.
Yeah.
You would have been better off putting a pig valve or a cow valve in or whatever.
Right.
Something. And so I was around that and worked with that.
Something
two
in
or 3 years.
George Bain would have been in there, maybe Byron Hayes.
George was in there at my very end, I believe. I don't think.
Okay.
George might have been there while I was there, but there are a few people that you'll know that, they went over there, and I was the first probably of that medium of rowing boats, Grand Canyon, Colorado River, all the hiking and everything. I was over there. And to have a great job in Flagstaff at that time, a job that you can live in Flagstaff on and enjoy, that was really a valuable thing. So when people, I was around river people and George Bain and a handful of other folks, and they saw that, if we could get in there. I imagine this, they thought, I've got this background. I could get in over there, I bet.
Right.
And they got in.
Right.
And off they went.
Okay, so hang on a second. Let's back up a little bit. And let's,
we're going to have to.
Yeah, because we sort of raced ahead here a little bit. So you showed up at M&A. You'd been fired from ARTA. And did you, it's kind of a joke here in town where, you got hired from this river company. Well, walk across the street and go talk to that one. They'll hire you over there. Did you think about, going over and talking to Oars or any of the other companies that were, based out of Fredonia, Martin Litton's Grand Canyon Dories was going then. Not quite. No, he hadn't started yet. He didn't start until, he did right about that time. 72. That's right. So there were other companies there, but was it just happenstance that kind of, Pete said, go talk to M&A.
Well, I wasn't going to pick another company. At least I hadn't gotten to that point yet. But one thing that I did get is one of the little tiny companies, great company, all family run. They had a permit. Luckily, at some point in the early beginnings, they got a permit. If you mention some of the little mom and pop.
Where were they based out of? Flagstaff or Page or
not those.
Fredonia.
It would have been. I would have thought up probably where the Dories were set up. Not probably in Hurricane, but in that area up there. Maybe it was close to Fredonia. What's the name of that?
I think of Tour West. I think of Western.
No. Big tiny. Funny name too for them.
Crate, Colorado River and Trails. Tony Sparks' company. What was the name of his company?
Yeah, think about that.
Okay.
But they called me up. I wasn't doing anything. I was home, you know, I was in Santa Cruz, and I was, you know, music and surfing was what I was doing. That's what I wanted to do, and that's why I left Flagstaff, and that's what I was doing. And then to get a phone call from this group, wonderful name for this little company, but they were really nice. I think the wife called me up and said, can you come out and row? We need a boatman to row practically like next midweek week. Can you drive out or fly out?
Was that Mokey Mac?
Yeah, it was like Mokey Mac.
Like Pam Quist?
Yeah, it might have been Pam.
Okay.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, Mokey Mac. Yeah. And so they called me and told me their situation, that they needed somebody, and they couldn't get anybody that was qualified. And I think probably certain licensing may have kicked in finally by then, and certain first aid classes and so forth. And so they needed somebody that could fit the bill for them and come out and work, and not work for a lot, but get them out of a bind because they needed people. And
so is this still in the 1970s? Are we like later on 1977 or 78 ish?
Yeah. If we get up to 77, I've gotten out of M&A, at 77.
Okay.
So it was probably, you know, we have to go back because M&A picked me up. This goes back to, did I go and hustle jobs anywhere? Well, I got when it was found out that I wasn't working. That's when, through the boatman's newsletter or whatever that thing is that's still going on, I think I signed up for something. I was getting that newsletter, and they said, send this card back. If you want to do part-time work for any outfitters, we'll put you in a bank of this guy will work a trip here and a trip there. Yeah, so I answered that. And so that was my first call was from Mokey Mac. And they needed somebody, and it was like, I go, wow, here I am all the way in Santa Cruz doing a wholly different thing. I'm trying to get away from all this river stuff, and I'm trying to change my life, you know. And I talked to Kenton Grua and a few other people down in the canyon with my idea of, like, I want to get out of this. I don't want to do this forever. I'm bored down here, and it's just time to get out. I don't want to be here anymore. And Kenton, I will never forget, he just looked at me and go, how could you ever leave this place?
Mm.
And Kenton, I met a lot of times with the speed trips and other stuff down there. We interacted quite a bit. Also his canyon hike too. George Billingsley and I picked him up at the end. And so I knew Kenton and all these people. And, Kenton just looked at me and said, how could you ever leave this place? And his heart was so full of what he did, what he does, what the canyon was to him, what the Colorado, what the trips were all about for him. And he was so sincere that he just couldn't fathom leaving. He said, you know, you've got it all and you're going to leave this? Man, I'll never leave this. You know, that's Kenton. Mm-hmm. And then the other fellow was, what's his name? But there's another fellow that's equal to Kenton that's still out there rowing. And he said, yeah, I've often thought of that. I thought about leaving. I should get out of this, you know, and blah, blah, blah. But he ended up staying with it. And I still see his name on certain things. And but I wanted to throw it all out to all these near and dear people, like, I'm getting out of it. I don't want to do it. And I've done it, and it's time to move on. I want to do something different. I didn't want to be down the canyon for all that time it takes to do the trips, get off. I'm gone from the world all the time, and there's stuff I want to do up top now. I mean, I've done this beyond what anybody gets to do. You know, it's time. I can do it anytime I want. I can do anything, but I don't need to do it all the time now.
Right.
That's what got me out of it.
So let's go back for a bit. Now we've moved ahead. Let's go back to M&A. And you've got a job working with Carruthers. Tell me about your first impressions of Steve and some of the first river trips you did with Steve Carruthers.
Steve Carruthers was a real, and anything I say won't be necessarily in a bad way. It's just, he was a pretty macho man's man kind of guy. And here, he and I got along great. We had to get along great. Mm-hmm. And he'd always ask me for my, what do you think about this? And what do you think we should do here? And can we make this campsite? Or are we too far up in the canyon and we can't do this? You know, how can we do this? And so I was, it was good working for him. I don't usually surround myself with people that are, you know, real macho and tough guy kind of, even though he's a great scientist and biologist. He ran the whole thing, all the biology. And, but, you know, he was he could be a tough guy.
Okay.
And he had a lot going on for him, and he wanted a lot, and he got a lot. And, so it was, you know, it was interesting. It was good. I did all my trips basically with him. But at some point, kind of like I was talking about, I was feeling he had more work to do, back in Flagstaff at M&A than being out on the river all the time. So it wore on him as well. So it was,
well, somebody had to write the reports. So
all that stuff.
Yeah.
And all the biologists had to get their notes together and keep up to date on what they'd found down there.
Hmm.
So it's not like, you know, whoopee-doo, we're on the river and blah, blah, blah. It was like, God, I got so much work to do at home, and I've got this meeting and event to go to. And so there was a lot of those kind of driving things for everybody,
okay,
except for me. All I had to do was take the trip. And
yeah.
And then there were times that Steve would say, I'm not going to go. I'm not going on this trip. All right. And then it would be another trip. I'm not going to take the time. You guys do it. And so I would go out without Steve, and if I needed to hire guides, I would hire guides and whatever it took to get everybody down.
Okay.
And there was one time which, for, I'm not sure the reason on this, maybe it's because we didn't have enough equipment or we didn't have enough people to row, but I was sent out on a trip with five or six scientists, and I invited my girlfriend to come out from California, and she came on the trip. And he wanted it to be a single boat trip. So, and these were all on snout rigs. And so I said, I'll do a single boat trip if that's, you know, what's demanded. I'll go out by myself with all the scientists and my girlfriend. And
wow, wait a minute. So you're going to row a snout that's going to have like 8 people on it with all their gear and food and everything? That's a huge, heavy boat.
Oh, I didn't realize that frame of mind that you just mentioned until I loaded the boat up, and it took a bunch of us to push it off the shore, and I rowed it off the shore, and I go, not only is there no room on this boat for all these people, it's heavier than anything I've ever rowed before.
Wow.
This thing is going to be so unmanageable.
Yeah.
And I think the trip was in October, so there was nobody on the river. No motor rigs were on the river, no rowing trips, no private trips. It was like me pushing off with, I think, 6 or 7 people.
Wow.
All the food for 3 weeks, all the emergency gear for 3 weeks, probably a motor went on the boat. Sometimes I take the a motor to get us off the lake or whatever. And the winds were so bad sometimes that,
yeah,
I had to run the motor to to beat the wind and get down canyon. And,
mm-hmm,
and there,
mm-hmm,
was also time constraints. We needed to be at Phantom, or we needed to be at this campsite, or we needed to be at this takeout, and we needed to make it across Lake Mead. All this stuff, you know. And so it was a biggest shock to get everybody on the boat, push off,
And people are just sitting on top of, they're not inside the boat. They're just sitting on top of all the gear it takes to run
right. Eight
people for 3 weeks. And and let alone the risk that I was responsible for to row this big, heavy boat with no support from, you know, happenstance motor rigs coming by and finding me, you know, stuck in a eddy or on a rock somewhere
right.
or whatever. You know, I had no support whatsoever. And that was really a test. There was so much to risk, and it was all on me. And there were some moments. I'll tell you two moments if you want.
Yeah.
Or if you want to move. Okay.
No.
With all of that in my mind, as I've told you, and all of that on my shoulders, and never forgetting repercussions of a mistake, I can remember coming into Granite Rapid, and Granite Rapid is kind of a rapid that has no secret run. In my time there, it was no, like, guaranteed secret perfect run, not in the middle, not on the far left side, not start on the far right side. You know, hug the wall. It's kind of like V-waves and other kind of rebound waves in there. And so I'm at Granite, and I kind of set myself up to go down sort of on the right-hand side. The eddy at the bottom of Granite, I didn't think really if I got stuck on that eddy. I have been in there, and it took so much effort to
yep.
get out with the currents and the eddy lines.
Yep.
And so I knew I couldn't get in that eddy. That would have been it. Being there when I've had to pull people out, you know, throw a rope, stay in current and pull them out. I've been in there where I didn't think, how many times do I have to go around? I mean, I can't keep doing this. I got to get out. So I probably biased my right side run. Well, what happened is that my snout clipped the wall and spun me 180. And on Granite, on that wall, there was a notch of rock that from the wall that comes out. And with my boat turning 180 degrees, I stuffed the rear left side snout, the stern of my snout rig, I stuffed it right into that notch that stuck out from the wall, and it stalled me right there.
Huh.
So you're in Granite Rapid with the main coursing rapid out in the middle there, not far from where I'm stuck on the wall.
Right.
And here I'm looking upstream on that wall, kind of pulsing from the force of the current and our boat going up and down and kind of nudging in the wall and coming back off. And
that's crazy.
And so I sat there and I go, hell, this is terrible. And, well, if I get off of the wall too abruptly, is the current going to flip me right there? And am I going to spin and go into the eddy at that point, or flip and go in the eddy with loose people? The island wasn't low enough water. The island below wasn't out, which could have been a place to have drifted onto, I guess. But anyway, can you imagine losing your boat at Granite and you're not close to anything? You're just, and you got people swimming, and God, it's a nightmare to even think about it. But I was there looking at the wall, looking at my stern, and planting my oar in. And also, that's so much force that it wasn't unusual to snap an oar when, if you stuffed it out there with all your strength
right.
and pulled against that current, you could snap your oar. And I probably couldn't afford losing an oar with only a spare, maybe two spares, maybe rowing a couple and then two spares. So anyway, we finally got off of that and went on down. And either, I don't know where we camped after that, but I got off of it. And then the next critical decision that I had to make with this single boat trip was I came into Crystal. And I came into Crystal at lowish water, and it was near nightfall, but not quite. Late afternoon, we'd hit Phantom, did whatever we had to do at Phantom, which sometimes was pick up some food, or we had to make a call somewhere or do something or check in. And so I went on down to Crystal, and I pulled in, and I had to make a decision because the Rock Island was well exposed on the right side, if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The Rock Island, everything was out, as bad as it could be, it was out. And so I sat there by myself. Everybody else is up at the boat waiting for me to come back. And I just sat and watched the river pulse and look at what kind of opportunities I'd have on the far right going through the island. And having seen the island many times, never choosing to go in the island ever, having hung my dory up, flipped in Crystal in my dory when I ran it for Azra, flipped in Crystal on the corner with my dory, flipped and landed on the island, and luckily it was low enough water that we were able to get a rope out to me, or there was a little ducky on the trip that they could get a rope out to me, and I tied off, and then the whole crew and some other passengers were able to right me. So I have dodged that island. I've been stuck upside down on that island. I've pulled boats off of that island, and I knew what it took if you made a mistake with that island. So those are my thoughts. And then looking at the hole, which we hadn't run the hole in many years, we hadn't set up to run that hole, either left of it or dead center or whatever. And so I'm looking at the hole going, you know, this might be the only safe thing for me to do in late afternoon coming on to evening. If I get stuck on that island, there's nobody coming down. We have no communication. And people are going to, we're going to have to, what a nightmare. And then we go down to Tuna Creek. You know, can we get people off the island to swim to get to shore? Not practical at all. And then if they don't, then they're going to go through Tuna Creek. Then they're going to go through all the rubies and all the jewels down there. I mean, might as well just drown them right there, guys. You know, so that's another thing I'm thinking about. What are the repercussions now? And so I made a decision to go and hit the hole dead center and come into it as straight and as powerful as I could. And I sat there at Crystal Creek on my walk back to the boat, and I drank a little bit of water right there as kind of a blessing, like a spiritual moment to praise God and that my decision will be a success and be with me on my path I'm going to take. And another friend of mine, Tom Olson, that we had row for us in winter trips and other times, he always said, when I walk back from a check-in Crystal, I always take a drink of the water there before I get to my boat. And that's my grace right there, is to hope that everything goes well. And so I sat there at the creek there, absolutely, again, just swamped with the effort and the work and the shoulders that I'm bearing all this drama for. I go, okay, go out there and run center in Crystal. And that's what you're going to do. Pushed off with everybody. I said, okay, want everybody to hang on. And we're going to, it's not a real bad hole today, but we're going to run Crystal. So I just, everybody hang on, and we're going to run it and make it through. And then we'll have various rapids right after that. So anyway, hang on, make sure your life jackets are buckled. Let me see everybody's jackets. Everything that needs to be tied down should be tied down. No loose ammo cans, no loose spare oars. Everything was checked. Loads were tied down. Lids were clamped down on rocket boxes and so forth. And we pushed off, and I gentled my way out into the middle of the current, and it took me right down center. I don't recollect having to fight much current going right, which is a problem. But I set up to make sure I could defend from going to the island, and I was committed, And that's key for anybody rowing, is to make a commitment and follow through with that commitment. And don't change your mind and go, oh, this is, no, that's not going to work. I got to do it this way now. It doesn't happen. You've got to commit, and that's it. And you work towards that commitment. And when it's over, you can say, I did my best. I mean, I thought that was the spot, but, you know. So anyway, there we go. That was one of, those were two of my, amongst other climactic times in my life down in the Grand Canyon with responsibility and just heavy stuff to the shoulder.
So punched through the hole and then ran the left side around the left side of the island.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you hit the hole, you're not. The only thing the island's doing is the current wants to put you at the island. You've got to set up, whether it's your ferry angle or whatever, but you'll go to the island unless...
unless you do something different, you go right or left.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're going to go right over there.
Yeah.
So I don't remember if to dodge the island, I had turned my boat and ferried it with the strong poles to keep me off of the island and bring me back to center on the falls at Crystal. I probably had to do that. I couldn't have pushed hard enough to keep my boat to the left. But there is no way. I defended initially from going over to the right. That's how my defense in rowing went.
Okay.
And making sure everything was lined up to stay center on the hole. And so, went through, and we hit it squarely. And I have been through Crystal in that hole when it's just been mammoth. And it was not mammoth when I went through this time, so it let me through. We went deep drop down to the bottom, deep rise up to the top and through the rooster tail, flop down on the backside, and it was pure joy, more joy in me than the people that were just happy they blah, 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 you know.
Right.
I just going, wow, they'll never know what I went through, and I'll never tell them.
Mm.
All I told them is that this is what we're going to do, and hang on. And but you never want to ever show your cards to people that are counting on you.
Right.
And you just, you know, that's what your job is to do your best and keep people's, boy, if you lose their confidence and you lose their heart, you know, you've lost a lot. You have lost the trip. If they don't trust you or they won't listen to your commands or any mistake that's made, they get freaked.
Right.
You don't want a freaked out group of people. And
you have
you
to have
confidence.
The calm, cool collection of a submarine commander.
Yeah. And you don't vary from that. And if you ever screw up on all that, you're going to find out, I should have never done that or screwed up. You know, now they're on to me. And never want to go that route. And if you need to have the experience to know the reason, then go for it, man. But
so it was late in the day you ran Crystal. Where did you go for camp?
Okay, we went down, we did the Jewels, Tuna Jewels,
okay.
And then probably went to Ruby after that,
okay.
Ruby camp on the right. We might have gone all the way down to Bass, but I doubt it. I think that was that would have been just another leg that I wasn't probably up for, I guess.
Yeah, okay.
I wanted to get to camp, get cooking, and, you know, I hate cooking in the dark, and that happens one too many times, so... That's another one of the things you want to do on a trip is make sure you can get to camp when there's still daylight.
Right.
And
right.
You got people who can help you and on. And we're all hungry. We're all starved. We're all worn out.
Right.
Let's eat, you know. Let's party and eat. Done. So anyway, those are two of the rather intriguing, scary moments.
Yeah. Let me back up a little bit. There's a rapid in Marble Canyon called MNA Rapid.
I know all about it.
Okay. Let's see. Hang on a second. We've been going on about an hour and 10 minutes here. Would it be a good place to stop and talk about MNA Rapid next time?
Yeah, that's a good start because it's that was really a fun, just talk about another one of the moments that how many people get to experience this?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, totally. I mean, my God, I'm looking at something that I don't even understand.
Okay, wait. Don't spill the beans here.
No, I won't. No, I'll stop.
Okay. Well, with that, let's Let's conclude part six of Grand Canyon Oral History with Scott Imslin. Today is Tuesday. It's May 9th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Scott, thank you so very, very much.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. You again have brought me back into a land that I knew many decades ago, and you got me to relive it and enjoy the pleasure of reliving it. And it, you bring it to life, and that's really good. Thank you so much.
All right, hang on a second. Okay. Mm-hmm.